الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله
In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, the Creator and the Sustainer of the Universe, peace and blessings upon His servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Amin. I bear witness that there is no God worthy of worship except for the one God, and I bear witness that Muhammad is the slave servant and messenger of God. I greet you with the universal greetings of peace, the greetings that have been used by all of the prophets, from Prophet Abraham to Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. In our Islam in Focus program today, we have our 12th program in our series on the pillars of Islam. In today's program, we'll have our concluding program on Hajj, or pilgrimage to Mecca. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and joining me on the program today is Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Now, this is our final program on Hajj. I wonder if perhaps you could very quickly go back and just highlight some of the main points that we touched upon in our earlier programs dealing with the subject of pilgrimage to Mecca.
Okay. Last time we started first by making a distinction between the lesser pilgrimage called Umrah and the great pilgrimage, which is mandatory on every Muslim who is able to do it. And we said that the lesser pilgrimage can be done at any time. It's constituted of visiting the holy house, the sacred house, the Kaaba, and doing a few rites, which only can take a couple of hours, really. Secondly, we said that in order to go for either types of pilgrimage, the person should enter into a state of consecration. It's called ihram, which involves both the intention to do that in obedience and devotion to God, which is also constituting of wearing this kind of attire that I explained last time, which is simply one simple piece of cloth to be wrapped around the waist to cover the lower part of the body, and another one just to cover the upper part, leaving the left arm exposed. And we said, we discussed also the wisdom behind it, that the person is casting behind himself the ego, clothing as a symbol of wealth, or race, or nationality, or prestige, and becoming simply a human being wearing, like everybody else, that very simple, plain clothing. We said also that that state of consecration should take place actually before one enters Mecca. We described the boundaries of Mecca, and it said depending on the area where you're traveling from, the area that's regarded as Mecca ranges anywhere between 6 to 16 kilometers. However, this state of consecration should be entered into prior to entering Mecca. In fact, there are specific places allocated in various directions and specified by Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in which you should really be in the state of consecration. It ranges anywhere between about 94 or 100 kilometers to 500 kilometers around. So that's the state where you really should be observing this. And he said that the state of consecration is not merely merely intention plus simple dress, but it also involves being at perfect peace with other human beings, avoiding arguments and violence, with animals, not permitted to kill animals even for food or even insects, unless there is danger to your life, and even being at peace with others. Objects in nature, you're not allowed even to cut a tree or trim your fingers or cut your hair, just in a state of total peace and devotion. And he said while the person is going on his way to the Kaaba, there is a chanting, and I gave the translation last time of the chanting. And then he said the person goes next to the Kaaba, and there he makes seven circling or going around the Kaaba for seven times, with the Kaaba being on the left-hand side, and each one of these seven circumambulations or circling has to start from the corner where the cornerstone of the Kaaba, the black stone, is housed. So that organizes the whole movement. That was basically the essence of the first portion of the actual rites of pilgrimage as we discussed last time.
I'd like to look at the question of the black stone and its significance. This is something that's quite often misunderstood by Muslim and non-Muslim alike in terms of what the black stone is, what its significance is, And oftentimes people raise the question about the black stone, particularly in view of the fact that Islam is very, very particular about the whole question of worshipping images or adultery and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They're very much against that kind of thing. Can you explain what the black stone is and what its significance is?
Okay. The first point to indicate that the black stone is neither an idol or an image, and you said it rightfully, that in Islam you don't have any image whatsoever of God. Islam is very staunchly against idols or anything even that resembles idols. The black stone is simply a small piece of stone which is placed in one of the corners of the Kaaba. It doesn't have any particular shape, it's just a regular shape because of the passage of time, of course. It's not that big. And as far as the origin of the black stone, there are all kinds of speculations about it. Some traditions say that this was a meteoroid that fell from the sky, which actually looks like that because it's not totally black, it's really dark grayish. I saw it myself. There's another tradition that says that the angel brought that stone to Prophet Abraham about 3,000 years ago when he was building the Kaaba for the worship of the one God, to use it as like cornerstone of the building. However, there's something that's really certain about it, that there is no difference about. That the black stone is the only part that is believed to be remaining of the original structure of the sacred place, the Kaaba. Because throughout history, as you know, the Kaaba, because of natural disasters or other reasons, have been destroyed and rebuilt several times. But the black stone has always been there. That's the only thing that was really saved. So it's a kind of reminder of the origin of the building of the Kaaba itself. So when Muslims go for a pilgrimage and touch or kiss or point to the black stone, it has absolutely nothing to do with adoration in a sense of worship, because a Muslim worship God alone. Mm-hmm. But when you touch that stone, it really feels that you're identifying with Prophet Abraham, who is the spiritual father of monotheism, the father of both Israelite and Ishmaelite prophets. You feel that you're part of a community of believers that descended throughout history, and all prophets who taught the same basic monotheistic faith. It's a kind of emotional attachment, just like a relic from Prophet Abraham, our grandfather, the grandfather of all monotheistic faith, in fact. Not only this, as a relic itself, it doesn't have any particular significance, but that, a relic. The question of the kissing, which sometimes people wonder, well, would kissing mean worship? Which is absolutely irrelevant, really. We all have kids. We kiss our kids. We kiss our loved ones. But it doesn't mean that we worship them or take them for gods. Kissing simply means that this is something you cherish or you appreciate. And we definitely appreciate and cherish that relic of Prophet Abraham. It is important also to notice that as an evidence, an additional evidence of the fact that the black stone has no significance in itself, let me quote you two things. One was a statement made by a very, very good Muslim, Umar, who was the second caliph after Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. When he kissed that stone, he said, "I know that you are merely a stone, incapable of any good or harm. And had it been that I have seen Prophet, that's Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, doing that, I would have not even touched you." So that shows, again, it's simply a relic, really, nothing more. Mm-hmm. The other quotation also that it is desirable when one starts the circumambulation or the circling of the Kaaba, that he raises his hand. If it can't reach, you can just raise your hand and say, Bismillah, Wallahu Akbar. That's in the name of Allah or in the name of God. God is the greatest. So even though you're starting this point of movement there, you remember that God is the greatest. That nobody else that can share the divine attributes of God. Absolutely. Not an object, not a person. No matter who he might be. And when you continue on after saying that, you say also, Oh God, out of faith in you, acceptance of the book that you sent, that's the Quran. And out of the respect of the oath, that is the oath of faith in you, and following the path of your prophet, and then you can go on, continue making all kinds of supplication and prayers while you're going around the Kaaba. And by the way, the kissing of the stone or touching it is not really a requirement, because it is impossible when you have hundreds of thousands of people. It's very difficult to reach. And it suffices just to start, when you start circumambulation, just to raise your hand and say this, in the name of God, and God is the greatest, and just continue on. So the point that I hope is being made clear now is that the whole rites of pilgrimage, from the A to the Z, the whole life of a true devoted Muslim, from the A to the Z, is nothing but a continuous act of devotion to God alone, not absolutely to any object or any person, no matter how a person is great or prophet. It is simply, like I said, a relic from Prophet Abraham.
I want to thank you for clarifying that, because as I mentioned, this is a commonly misunderstood thing, particularly among non-Muslims.
Yes.
Now, after the Kaaba has been circled, what takes place next?
Well, next to that, the pilgrim, after he finishes
going around,
goes to a place which is nearby the Kaaba. It's called the Station of Abraham. You notice here there is a small structure. There is some glass casing around it. I was fortunate enough to be able to get close and look under. Actually, what it contains is the footprint of Prophet Abraham when he was building the Kaaba. Apparently it was moist at that time, and then it dried, and it's still, you could see a footprint, a relatively big foot, you know. Actually, it was said that Prophet Abraham was standing on that rock or stone when he was trying to place the black stone in the as a cornerstone of the building of the Kaaba, and used it also to just lift or place the stones in the building. It's interesting to remember here that it also reminds us that Prophet Abraham was not building this house for himself. As you know, it was built in devotion to God as the center of monotheism for the use of his son, Prophet Ishmael, peace be upon him, and all the descendants who came after him, and presently the millions of Muslims from all over the world who go there to worship God and visit the sacred house. After this, the pilgrim moved to a nearby place, which is called Safa and Marwa. And this is just like two small hillocks, or hillocks I should say, small hills, about one quarter of a mile apart. The pilgrim is supposed to go seven one ways, not double, just seven one ways, from one direction to the other is counted as one. Those, of course, who are weak or sick can be carried. This particular picture doesn't show it, but there are facilities available for the old or weak to be carried. And after finishing the seven rounds, most pilgrims can cut their hairs just as a symbolic of ending this procedure. Cutting even a few hair would do it, and then moving to the well of Zamzam to drink from it. Of course, considering the huge number of pilgrims, there are facilities there on both sides, one for women, one for men, and the water is pumped out of that well of Zamzam. As you notice here, there are a number of faucets that people go there to drink from it or make ablution, if they wish, in preparation for the prayers. This is, by the way, the same well that gushed under the feet of Prophet Ishmael when he was a baby, that I mentioned last time. So it has significance both in history as well as blessing, really, coming with it.
Right. I wonder if perhaps you could develop this point about, you know, hastening between the two hills. What is the significance of going back and forth?
Okay, this actually is reenactment of what Hagar, the second wife of Prophet Abraham, peace be upon him, did when Abraham left her along with her son, baby Ishmael, at this time, alone, when she ran out of water. You might recall in a previous program we've gone into some more detail about the origin of it, that she started searching for water between Safa and Marwa, looking for any passerby who might have water for the baby. And then after she finished the seven rounds, she went back to check on her baby, and she found miraculously that the well of Zamzam was gushing under his feet when he was crying and kicking the earth with his heels. This is the same well that exists so far. But since we talked about the historical part of it, perhaps I suppose that you're asking me about some of the lessons that one may be able to derive from why should they go in addition to commemoration.
Yes, it's important.
Well, there are a number of good lessons to be learned here, and they all reflect the Islamic way of thinking. First of all, when Hagar was left in a desolate place, no plants, no water, nobody else, she did not simply sit down to cry and wait for her death and the death of her infant. She knew that there was nobody around to bring her water. She ran out of water. She knew that death was almost certain. But she did not adopt a fatalistic approach. I can do nothing about it. So it's a lesson that shows Islam rejects this attitude of fatalism. But you should try to do something, little as it may be. Secondly, it's a great lesson in certitude and trust in God. She's alone. There is nothing. But still, she's running on the hope that God, or God's mercy, will still find a way for her out of that difficulty. And this is always should be the attitude of a devoted person. No matter how much tribulation or difficulty, a person should always live by the hope that God's solution and compassion may not be too far away. But a third lesson perhaps is relatively even more important, and at least in my thinking. For hundreds of years now, since Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, came, and even before him, people still used to commemorate that incident. But particularly when pilgrimage became an institution in Islam. For hundreds of years, at least 1400 years, since the days of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, we find that hundreds of millions of people have ran between the hills of Safa and Marwa. At present, nearly 2 million or more, because many people also go outside of the great pilgrimage period. Hundreds of millions of people are annually running between these two hills. And whose footsteps are they following? They're following the footsteps of a poor, humble, believed to be African bondwoman. Everybody, king or heads of state, people from professions, wealthy, poor, everybody from all walks of life is following the steps of that very simple, humble, poor bondwoman. And that carries a great deal of significance. Number one, it shows in a conclusive way the true Islamic attitude towards human brotherhood. That those whole artificial barriers that humans have created by way of racial superiority, ethnic superiority, sex superiority, has nothing to do in the sight of God with the basic human and spiritual qualities, which is really what counts. Among all people, like one scholar said, a woman. And among all women, a poor and bond woman. And everybody commemorates her, pay respects to her, and show this. In a way also, it reflects the profound respect that Islam gives to women, which is something, again, that has been greatly distorted by many uninformed and misinformed, and you could say, and misinformed writers about Islam. The fact that everybody, including the Prophet himself, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was following the steps of that humble woman. And this is not the only incident. In the Quran itself, we find praise of many saintly women. Indeed, there is a whole chapter in the Quran, chapter 19, called the chapter of Mary, after the name of Virgin Mary, the mother of Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him. So it shows Islamic respect for women, and particularly for motherhood, because that running, of course, was an expression of motherhood, which again, in Islam, is regarded as the cornerstone and foundation of society. Destroy the institute of motherhood, and you set the society in motion towards self-destruction. So there are lots of thoughts that many Muslims feel. I felt it myself running between the Safa and Marwa, commemorating this unique experience.
Before we go on and examine the rites of the greater pilgrimage, I'd like to just ask you about another common point that's often raised by non-Muslim writers, and that has to do with the suggestion that that many of them make that the rites of the pilgrimage were practiced by pre-Islamic Arab pagans, and by inference suggesting that when Islam came along, many of these customs were just more or less tolerated or became, you know, part of the Islamic tradition or custom. How would you respond to a claim like that?
This is a half-truth, and sometimes half-truths are more harmful than not saying anything on the part of those writers, because they don't carry the information far enough. It is true, yes, that before Islam, even the pagan Arabs used to observe some of those rites of pilgrimage. But did they invent it? They didn't. The pagan Arabs were simply following what remained in that tradition of the original rites which were done since the days of Prophet Ishmael. So why not carry it far enough to its monotheistic origin? See, this is the very simple fault, you know, in the logic of presenting this argument. What Islam did is not to adopt any pagan practice, because they were in themselves imitating the practice of Prophet Ishmael, who was a monotheistic prophet like his father Abraham. Right? What Islam did was simply to restore the Kaaba to its original purpose, to restore the rites of pilgrimage to its original pure form. For example, the Kaaba was there. It was dedicated originally by Prophet Abraham for the worship of the one God.
Yes.
The pre-Islam pagan Arabs corrupted this Kaaba by placing inside it idols. When Islam came, it destroyed and removed those idols. It doesn't say that it adopted the Kaaba that was used by idol worshippers. It simply says it restored it, removed, cleaned it from idolatry. In pilgrimage also, if we have time, I could have gone on and on explaining again certain reforms that Islam introduced. For example, in pre-Islamic days, they used to make the round about the Kaaba naked. Men during the day, women during the night. Islam forbid that, because again, it's contrary to the rules of modesty also that Islam provides. So it's simply a restoration to the original use.
I'd like to move on now then to the greater pilgrimage. Could you perhaps give us a description of what activities, what rites are involved in the greater pilgrimage?
Okay, to give a brief explanation, of course, once we enter also into the greater pilgrimage, you have to be in the same state of consecration, the same kind of dress like I explained before. So everything that we mentioned about lesser pilgrimage apply as well. It starts on the 8th day of Dhul Hijjah, the 12th month in Islamic calendar, where the pilgrims move to a place called Mina, which is about 15 kilometers outside of Mecca. They wait there until the following day, which is the 9th, and that's the climax, the day where the climax of pilgrimage takes place. After they pray the noon prayer, they enter into the plain called the plain of Arafat. They go to this to spend the whole day in utter devotion to God. the term Arafat is etymologically derived from knowledge, Arafa. Mm-hmm. It is a vast, empty plain surrounded with dark lava peaks covered with soft sands. Standing in the mount or this plain of Arafat is indeed a unique experience. In this slide here, we have the Mount of Mercy, where Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, gave his last sermon before his death, the farewell sermon, as it's known. But the feeling that you have there is indeed amazing. You get nearly 2 million people, at least according to recent years' estimate, standing there in devotion to God, males and females. Blacks, whites, reds, yellows, people from all ethnic backgrounds, from all walks of life and professions, from all corners of the earth, showing in a practical way that social origin, race, ethnic orientation, wealth or profession has no bearing on the basic spiritual and human qualities of the human being. Indeed, this particular experience, which is amazing, was the primary thing that moved the late Shabazz, known as Malcolm X, to have his ideas changed concerning this whole issue of racial superiority, and came from this pilgrimage with the notion that no racial superiority, black or white, should be tolerated, that all humans are brothers in the face of God. The other thing that you notice also when you look at the scene in Arafat is that it reminds people with death, resurrection, and standing of all races, groups before God for the final judgment. It is indeed a very unique and powerful, profound experience that you've got to be there to really get the feel of it.
Brother, now, when the pilgrim leaves Arafat, what remaining activities or rites are there?
Okay, they go to a place called Muzdalifa, and just again, a simple plain where they spend the night in vigil and relaxing a little bit. At dawn, they wake up for morning prayers, and then after sunrise, they go to a place called Mina, where they make a stoning, symbolical stoning. You notice here there is a stone pillar, and they take small pebbles and throw it, which symbolizes victory over Satan and evil prompting within ourselves. And then after they finish that, they can just cut a little bit of their hair also, symbolizing the end of the restrictions of Ihram, or most of it. Following this, they move to a place called Mina, which is about halfway through between Mecca to Arafat. And here they make the sacrifice of the animals. After this is finished, they go to the Kaaba, as you see here, to make another circling of the Kaaba called Ifada. And this should be really the ending of the procedures of pilgrimage itself. However, before departing Mecca, if they stay longer than that, they go also to make another circumambulation or circling, which is called the farewell circling. It is desirable for the pilgrims to spend a couple of two or three more nights in the place called Mina, and every day they go again for this symbolical stoning of the devil, which again symbolizes victory over evil collectively by the community of believers. Finally, those who have time, they can go to visit the Medina and pray day in the mosque of the Prophet, which again, as I indicated before, is not an absolute requirement of pilgrimage, but it's desirable if people are there. And then they come home, hopefully, with a new rebirth, with a new inspiration and sense of purpose in their lives. No wonder then that we find Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, say that a person who does pilgrimage properly comes back clean from sins as the day when his mother gives birth to him.
Thank you, Brother Jamal. This concludes our final program in our series on Pillars of Islam. We want you to join us next week when we'll start our new series dealing with the moral teachings in Islam. Thank you for watching Islam in Focus. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.